CliffCentral.com.
All right, CliffCentral.com on a Thursday morning. It's already the 23rd of April, and you've been in lockdown for over a month. Well, 28 days by now, right? So it's starting to get on people's nerves, but governments say they've done a terrific job here, and they want us to know that it's been a tremendous success. Cyril didn't waste time when he came on the TV on, what was it, Tuesday night to say, oh, the lockdown has been very good. It's been great a success, like Borat would have said. But this morning, we're going to look at what's going on in the world of current affairs. It's something we do every single week. We try to get some of the smarter people that we can find around South Africa to give us sometimes very alternative points of view, sometimes quite mainstream points of view, but we get into the detail of it and we hopefully add some value to your experience. And of course, this is something that you can share with your friends. It's something you can pass around on social media. It is the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's every week. I'm joined by Canthan Pillay, who is our repeat champion, our returning champion. And this morning, Russell Lamberti. Russell is the founder of investment advisory firm ETM Macro Advisors. He is also the co-author of When Money Destroys Nations, which I think is more apt than ever. It's a book about Zimbabwe's hyperinflation crisis, and he lives in Cape Town. He joins us on the line this morning. Canthan is in Plettenberg Bay, where he and his family are in lockdown. So, good morning, everybody. I hope everyone is in good spirits, despite the fact that we are stuck in a lockdown which seems interminable at this point. Apparently, we're going to have some more announcements today about how the lockdown is going to be eased off, how the economy is going to be opened up again. Aren't we lucky that our governments allow us to trade and do business with each other? That's what we should all be, is supplicant and on our knees saying thank you, thank you, thank you. Canthan, how have you started to feel since our last conversation in the light of what the president said on Tuesday, where he's giving away all this money like Santa Claus?
Well, I consider the fact that the president is pretty much giving away all of our money.
Yeah, well,
and
money we don't even
this
have.
Bobby. Well, that's the point. He's not only giving away our money, he's also giving away the money from my grandkids. And this will probably be great-grandkids as well. It's the IMF and not the Chinese. So there's a bit of a silver lining there. What do you think?
Well, Russell, it's nice to see you. I've been trying to get you on the podcast for the longest time. Just unmute your microphone there and let's talk to you, because in your opinion, lockdown failed on day one, which is quite something to say. Do you want to explain that and then maybe get to your comments on Tuesday's announcements?
Yeah, thanks, Gareth. It's great to be here. Hope I'm coming through loud and clear. Yeah, I have never supported anything that has attempted to do something so radical to society as producing their means of survival.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that to do that en masse across an entire country of 60 million people doing it as well, so we really got it across a few billion people, is going to go down as probably one of the and silliest things in history. And I just think that there's more nuanced, smarter, better risk management strategies, Gareth. So, yeah, I think it's failed from day one. I think people didn't realize it very early on because, hey, the first week of lockdown feels kind of like a little Christmas break, you know. Mm. But now we're 4 weeks into this thing. We're going to go 5 weeks. We're probably going to do some form of pretty intense lockdown through May, maybe not, you know, the full extent of what we have. And that could extend into June as well, given the sort of troop announcements from the president, which I'm sure we'll get into. And I'm starting to sense a real desperation. And for the first time, desperation in people's hearts and minds. And I'm worried, very worried about where this is going.
Well, you know, we don't need to get into the merits of the disease, because there are lots and lots of people, some of them expert and some of them not, telling us that this disease may or may not be better or worse, and I use those terms very loosely, than we had at first anticipated. But what we do know for sure is that when you cut off people's income and when you cut off their ability to go out and earn a living and put together some kind of a life for their families. We know the consequences of that, and the consequences of that are always bad. So it's a tough job if you're a government anywhere in the world. And I'm glad that you also referenced, Russell, that there are other countries who've made exactly the same moves, for better or for worse. I mean, America's divided right down the middle about what to do now. Do we carry on with lockdown? Mm-hmm. Some of the governors are getting more and more, let's say, draconian and capricious about their regulations around this. And in South Africa, we do see a very out-of-touch elite. I mean, we've got ministers who, like Stella and Benny Abrams, were going to lunch with fellow political colleagues. And we have other ministers who are driving around blue light brigades, who have everything paid for by the state, who don't know what it's like to have no opportunity on the horizon. And this elite in South Africa have become so out of touch that maybe when they make their decisions and when they have their conferences, they say and do the things that we think they should say and do. But actually, deep down inside, they're disconnected. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's very important. What we're seeing here, Gareth, is the culmination, almost like the perfection of the out-of-touchness of the elites. To institute a lockdown, keeping your salary for a month in your big house with a nice big garden and good internet, someone in a township to sit in a 3x3 shack with no means to move around and obtain resources desperately for them and their families. I can't imagine a more out of touch this problem. It's astonishing. It actually is. If it wasn't so tragic, I think it's that out of touch. And you're right, we can debate the merits of the virus, and that's kind of a separate discussion. Mm. I think that this virus would have to be orders of magnitude worse, and attacking, our young children, for us to be justifying such draconian measures. It's not that. Certainly in the last few weeks, as data's become, better, and we're getting some good data, pivoting. They need to be pivoting now. Every day is now crucial. That's really concerning.
So, Russell, because you are an economist and you're someone who looks at where the money goes and you're constantly analyzing the numbers, what do you make of the $500 billion that we're going to borrow in order to assuage some of the the damage to the economy? Do you think it's enough? Do you think it's too much? Do you think it's a bad idea? I mean, what would you have done? Because it's fine for us to sit here and criticize, but maybe our leaders just don't know what else to do, and they're doing whatever they think is necessary. And maybe we're being too critical.
Look, I think that they're frozen by greed. I think, there is a sense in which no leader wants to be pinned as the coronavirus killer,
Sure.
At the same time, I think that the ANC, and I think many governments, are seeing this as an opportunity to grow bureaucratic reach and power. You have a business, you want to grow your business. You have a bureaucracy, you want to grow your bureaucracy.
Sure.
There's no conspiracy here. This is just kind of, what guys want to do. So I think that's kind of a backdrop to this. Gareth, the only stimulus that matters right now, is ending lockdown. Hmm. Yes, you can then, the rest is kind of details, right? You can backstop the banking system a little bit. You can incentivize the banks to provide bridging finance to otherwise healthy businesses that are struggling. You can to certain households who were in good standing and have come under some pressure. There's some good things you can do there. You can repurpose the budget like they are doing for a while to provide food parcels and so on. We'll talk about the logistics and the corruption that'll be involved in that, as a separate issue. At least is good, and the idea is not unsound. But at the end of the day, lockdown, Gareth, the lockdown is like full tilt communism. It's like we're living in a situation where we just cannot produce the means of survival. And you can print as much money as you want, you can borrow as much money as you want. If people are not allowed to get back to work, this is the fundamental problem. So I just think that they've missed
And are you worried about the amount that we're borrowing? I mean, it's not as if our economy was in great shape before this. You know, we can look at how America might or might not be dealing with this well. But at least they had a booming economy before this. We had very little growth, if any. And, Canton, I'm going to bring you in a second because I know you've got lots to say about this too. But we're now borrowing $500 billion. It's equivalent to, what, 10% of our GDP for the year. And I've spoken to some other people who say, oh, but it's fine. We can amortize this over the period of the next 10 years, and it's not going to make that much of a difference. What do you make of that? Doing the numbers, what do you think of this? Yeah, I mean, you've written a book about hyperinflation. So what do you think is going to happen?
Look, first of all, at this stage, that $500 billion is not all borrowed. So it's $130 billion of repurposed existing spending. Look, we were already borrowing that in the first place. And to your point, we were on our knees as an economy pre. And in fact, quick little factoid is that get these databases that track civil unrest, riots, protests. Mm-hmm. Pre all this panic, this spiked, you know, about 50% higher than normal in South Africa. All right. That's a great indicator that things were already getting very, very tough for people on the ground. So lockdown has compounded this problem. We were on our knees coming into this. The entire $500 billion is not going to be borrowed. Big numbers, Gareth. We're talking $100, $200 billion initially of borrowing. They're backstopping or guaranteeing the bank lending program. Billion. And if those loans go bad, the government is essentially going to be obliged to take that onto its balance sheet to assume that debt. So for all intents and purposes, it will probably end up being $500 billion or more. Mm. Or more. And you know, to your point, we're a heavily indebted country. You know, prior to this, at the start of lockdown, as the markets were kind of crashing, staring a debt trap in the face, continuing to borrow more throughout this. And what often happens, final point, what often happens with this is when you start running out of avenues to borrow more money, governments think about the idea of printing money. Mm-hmm. There, right? And once you start down that road and you sort of embrace that policy fully, South Africa, and we've seen how badly it can go in Zimbabwe, you potentially start embarking down this road of hyperinflation, essentially the perfection of economic destruction. Right, it's the one place you absolutely don't want to go. It's even worse than actual lockdown, and that's my real concern here, is that we're flirting. We're not guaranteed to go there yet, but we're flirting with this kind of strategy.
Well, what do you have to say about that, Canton?
Well, just to drill down to the numbers that Russell was just talking about, if you consider that, and this is something we've spoken about in the past several weeks, Gareth, that you know, currently in terms of our budget deficit for this fiscal, we're already tracking R1 billion a day in terms of that. Hmm. Consider the fact that now adding another $500 million deficit to the existing $387 billion deficit that we have for the year. And, you know, as Russell points out, you know, some of it is simply repurposed from the existing budget. But the fact is, we're pretty much doubling the deficit that we have here. That's terrifying, if you think about it, because, you know, effectively we're going up to a deficit of something like R2 billion a day.
I've heard a figure that was quite alarming, and this allows people to figure out for themselves what it means. It means that essentially every South African, no matter how much you have or don't have, you suddenly owe. Because if we divide that deficit down the line to each person, each of us owes an extra R100,000 right now that we didn't owe the day before. And that's a scary number, because once you personalize it, like if I came to you and said, you owe me R100,000 now, a lot of us would, in fact, just about everybody would be on their knees if you had to suddenly pay over R100,000 now. We can't afford it, right? I mean, is that a fair number? Is that a reasonable estimate? About 100,000 each? Russell?
Sorry, guys.
Yeah, you were on.
I was trying to unmute my. I was trying to unmute my mic, and it wasn't quite working. Gareth, I'm just doing a bit of a quick calculation out here. So we've got 500
billion, and there are 59 million South Africans. It's quite a lot of zeros.
Yeah,
When you actually write out 500 billion, you realize how big that number is. It's kind of scary.
Yeah, but my calculation, it should be about 8,000 Rand per person. 8,474 Rand per person.
Yeah, but so, that's without, that's without the existing debt, and that's without...
But if you... Talking about the 500 billion divided among the lot that we have. But, you know, more to the point, we divide that among the economically active South Africans. Just every South African, because the bulk of the revenue that flows into this country. In fact, if you look into which is the single biggest source of revenue for the government, about 50% of the personal income tax comes from less than 500,000 people.
Yeah.
So, and that's fundamentally where the money is going to come from that group. But look, let's just touch on a couple of other things that Russell. So, the one thing is that the one reason right now why we're not likely to go the printing money route. Route effectively is because of the fact that there are the constitutional constraints in terms of doing that. In as much as there are a number of people within the ANC, the you know the Radical Economic Transformation Brigade, who would love to see a scenario where we're turning on the printing presses. Look, if effectively the ability to do unconstrained printing of money yet. Is there a possibility that you'll suddenly have an alliance between the ANC and the EFF to change the constitution, to change the mandate of the Reserve Bank to do that? Well, that's a possibility, but we haven't gotten to that stage yet. We have done in the short term is turning on the printing presses because the, you know, the drastic reduction in, the interest rates that we saw. Russell, I think it was quite extraordinary. I've never seen a spontaneous interest rate hike or decline outside of the monthly MPC meetings. But, you know, effectively what this is doing, it's injecting cash into the market, but it's cash that we actually don't have.
Yeah, Russell, you've stressed in an article that I read just a little earlier this week, you said that production is the issue. Do you want to explain that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a point that could take us down a rabbit hole, which we don't have to go all the way down. I just think at the end of the day, guys, and printing money and supporting demand and creating income, of all that stuff that we call income ultimately and that gives us our spending power is what we produce. It's what we make. Mm. It's the things we provide into the marketplace. That is what our that is what funds our ability to demand. You know, our ability to go to the shop, you know, at the Mall of Africa and storm is because we've produced something of value on the marketplace or we're in a position to extract value from someone else who produces in the marketplace, which is what taxation does and which is what money printing can do, right? The guys who are able to print money first, okay, the money itself is just pieces of paper or digits on a bank account. Mm-hmm. How does it confer purchasing power, existing real value in the system, right? That money essentially kind of expropriates or appropriates for themselves.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if the three of us got into a room and were able to print, you know, billions of rands without anyone knowing it, economy, and we could buy real things, we could, but it would be a wealth transfer. And so that's what not only money printing, but debt accumulation. Now all this debt that we're accumulating, someone actually borrows it. Someone's that money process, that money acquisition process, particularly if you start to print it. So the key is to get people producing again, and you want to have people producing pre-market system, because that is an excellent way to allocate production in this incredibly complex thing called society, right?
Yeah,
You try and centralize the planning of what you're going to produce and who's going to do what. I mean, you run into an absolute mess. Can't you know where all the resources should be allocated?
Well,
you end up having to force people to do things they don't want to do.
Ultimately, right? You then end up with things like price fixing or price setting, which obviously is a terrible system. And we know this. We've got countless examples in the 20th century of where regimes have tried to say, well, a mask or a glove or a ventilator will cost you X amount of money. And all that does is it fiddles with supply and demand, and the market can't then, from various inputs and outputs, decide what the appropriate price is for that thing. And you end up with it either being overvalued or undervalued, and the market then crashes around that product. So I don't think we need to go into the details of whether or not central planning is a bad idea. I think all but those who are completely economically illiterate would say that central planning is a very bad idea. It's politicians and ideologues who will stand up for the obverse of this. What I want to talk to you about, Russell, because another thing that you wrote is that you reckon the and I think this is probably something that a lot of us have thought about, even if we haven't necessarily known how to articulate the problem. The idea that defensive freedom is in business all too rare, and these are your own words, all too rare or murmured. You know, we often look at government and we blame government for things, but I think one of the things that South Africans are loath to do unless they are in government is to criticize the private sector. And I think that the private sector have some responsibility to speak out against this lockdown, at least make it clear that there is some opposition to it or that there are better ways to do things. And they've been absolutely dead quiet, particularly the healthcare sector, who may go out of business as a result of all of this. Certainly the case for the NHI has been advanced by this lockdown.
You've hit on a pretty sore point for me, I think. Looking upon large corporate South Africa and how it has rolled over into these lockdowns is pretty exasperating, I got to say. And you know, business, I love the way business produces value in the market, and great companies, they do great stuff, and they're good at what they do. They're good at making money. They're good at producing. They're innovative. South Africa has some great companies, right? Some really innovative companies. They've played, I think, the absolute wrong political long game. Potentially make the choice way back when to just kind of get on sides and get on board with the ANC, wherever that may lead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's led us to a very bad place. It's not led us to a good place. And I think that was probably felt like a good short-term business sort of, but it has led to such immense value destruction. I'm exasperated. And I just want to see corporate South Africa now as a sort of last ditch effort, because I think we're moving towards something like last chance saloon here, guys, on this, what this lockdown's going to do to break the sort of final leg of this very weak economy. There's big businesses really starting to stand up for the right stuff, which is things.
But how about just the ability to do business? I mean, no one, not a single voice,
exactly.
Not a single voice was raised publicly anyway. Because, you know, there's this funny channel of communication that government has with certain big corporations, and they have to because of labor. But you didn't hear any voices raised. Hey, guys, I don't know if this lockdown's a good idea. Or, Mr. President, we support you in trying to make sure that people in this country are healthy and that we save as many lives as possible. But we just want to warn that a lockdown could potentially have this and this and this this impact on the economy. Not one corporate voice was raised in that respect. Not one.
Yeah, and certainly none that were truly prominent. Again, it's always murmurings. It's behind the scenes. It's you know,
It's lacking in courage. That's what it is. We've got to call it what it is.
Yeah, but guys, you know, I just want to climb in at this point, because I think that, you know, in as much as we might be lacking in courage, the fact of the matter is that the power that the government wields over corporates is immense. The ability to actually hamper the ongoing operations of a business post this this scenario becomes a real business risk that particularly the large corporates have to deal with.
Sorry, man. Sorry to cut you off. If I may just jump in there quickly to that specific point. I mean, you're not wrong. Of course you're not wrong. But this is precisely why businesses need smart strategies. And it's why they need to club together in clever ways. And then they need to use their otherwise very good PR, you know, machines to change the narrative, right? These guys have the ability to change narratives, and they have the ability to adopt smart strategies and club together and come together. You know, these retailers, just quick example, these retailers with this chicken, cooked chicken fiasco.
Yeah.
That's like a PR dream to say, hey man, we're cooking chickens for the country. You know, we're making food for human beings, for doctors and nurses who come home late from their shifts and want some warm food.
Yeah.
Just rolled over. So I hear you, mate, on that, but they've missed a trick here, and they've played the wrong long game, you know, altogether. But you're not wrong that they've become in a.
I think it's not entirely fair in terms of the chicken stuff, because remember the first thing that Woolies did was they actually went out. And the legal advice that then came back said that in terms of the regulations, there was nothing that prohibiting the sale of food. What then happens, government then turns around and amends the regulations. So I think that, you know, certainly in Woolworth's case, I don't think that they were just rolling over. They actually immediately took appropriate steps to try and say, guys, actually, this doesn't make sense in terms of the very regulations that you proposed.
But why obey a bad regulation in the first place?
Well, because your ability to actually, your ability at that level to actually disobey the regulations is kind of constrained. Because let's say Woolworths turns around and extends a middle finger to government and says, all right, we are going to continue to serve hot chicken. Then government moves in and says, all right, in terms of the disaster declarations, we're actually shutting down Woolworths and we're allowing Pick and Pay and Spa and Checkers to continue operating. Yeah. You see, the question of whose bluff you end up calling, what's very clear, you can actually rely on this government to do one thing, and that's to pander to the egos of individual members of government over and above the interests of the state. If I was sitting as chief executive of Woolworths, see that I have to lose revenue over the next period at any case is to mitigate my losses during this time frame. You're going to be really careful about this. And there have been instances in the past. I mean, remember when Jordan and Real Cosa were running their respective banks. Mm. Both tried to create narratives that were contrary to what government at the time was doing. The result was a massive smack that came down from government. At the time, part of government to withdraw all business from FNB. You know, that would have been a massive impact on the bottom line, even though, you know, if you look in terms of Michael Jordan's FNB was trying to build as a narrative at the time. I think it was something that's addressing exactly the points that you're making, Russell. But guys, I don't want us to be kind of wallowing in the depths of despair out here, because not that I disagree with anything you've said so far, Russell, in terms of the state of the economy. But there's a couple of interesting things that I just want to flag. So one of them is, you know, the Institute of Race Relations has been putting together a range of strategies in terms of how one actually ease our way out of the lockdown. And there was a presentation that Herman Pretorius did earlier this week where he came up with the concept that you end up with a COVID-19 risk assessment on a per sector basis. Is that you can look at some of the sectors and say these are currently very high risk to start opening up immediately, and at others where it's actually low risk. So now we see that we have access to government's risk-adjusted strategy for economic activity, which I'm just taking a look at right now, this this PowerPoint presentation. And they've divided it into a range of sectors. And guess what? That approach. So immediately at the level of things that are extremely low risk that can or less immediately, you've got things like professional services, financial intermediation, long-term insurance, forestry, post and telecommunications, fiber optic and post and telecommunications, ICT and digital.
Right.
Then at the next tier, they move up to things like electricity, manufacturing, the defense industries, so forth. And then you go all the way to the top and you've got at the highest risk profile, you've got transport, aviation, you've got recreational, cultural and sporting activities, hotels, restaurants and retail takeaways.
Right.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's been a lot of the absence of more public on the issue and a more confrontational that the behind the scenes negotiations that have been taking place from the likes of the IRR and even from the Democratic Alliance in terms of the stuff that the Premier of the Western Cape had been putting forward, proposals that he has tabled to Ramaphosa, mm-hmm. have in fact actually ended up being accepted. This is quite the diplomacy. Right now, if I'm looking at the paperwork behind the scenes, I would gather that that is actually the case. So in other words, the likes of the IRR and the likes of the DA in terms of their engagement with government steadily chipping away at this disastrous edifice that they've put up. And really, I think this is going to be eating an elephant. It has to be one mouthful at a time. And as soon as we start taking away bits and pieces and opening up sectors of the economy as quickly as we can, which is not to say that the disastrous scenario that you foretell is wrong. I think it's correct.
I don't think it's about being positive or negative here either. I think we've got to deal with what we've got, right? So the reality is it is what it is. I'm curious about what both of you think about something else that's happening, because the ANC isn't monolithic. We know that in the ANC there are massive factions that are mounting, trying to take each other on. We have a lot of kind of Zuma's network of patronage who are still very much in place. And then we've got people like Tito Mboweni who do have an understanding of how the economy works. They do have an understanding of how capital flows. They get that we need to open things up quickly. And I'm sure there must be a sense of urgency when it comes to Treasury, because they're also looking at tax revenues, which are going to take an enormous decline during this time. And things like the sin taxes, which they would have made off of tobacco and liquor, for example, they're not able to get now. Plus, it's driving an underground black market, which is probably of great concern to them. Now, in the ANC, this has strengthened the hand of Cyril Ramaphosa, of Tito Mboweni, of people in that kind of quadrant of the ANC's ideological spectrum. Do you think that that's potentially given him some room to operate and given him a place to accumulate some more power and influence within his own party?
I guess
I don't read that the same. I don't read this as being good for Cyril Ramaphosa and for Tito Mboweni. They've been at the forefront of taking a decision that is likely to absolutely crash this economic system. And I think the people who potentially stand to benefit more are those waiting in the wings, the very silent Julius Malema at this point, whose silence is very, very interesting and I think very strategic. What Franz Cronier from the IRR calls the securocrats. So I know of as the state capture sort of faction that tends to sit around that security cluster, defense, intelligence, police. And then there's the socialists, right? The Ibrahim Patels, the SSTP, you know, portion of the alliance. Bureaucrats and these socialists, I think, are loving life under lockdown. R is expanding. They're flexing their muscles. Ibrahim Patel is not being reined in, at least not publicly, but in a way that you could see that you can see perceptibly. So I'm not convinced that this is. I mean, I see the scenario and I see the argument that Cyril Ramaphosa can use this chaos and can use this crisis to potentially pivot to some sort of reform. And I got to just say, guys, the track record doesn't fill me with confidence here.
Mm.
It's always a case of no, he's about to do it. He's just playing the long game. He's playing the 4D chess, and the reforms are incoming, guys. Just hold your horses. The track record just ain't there, guys. It's just not there. It's not there for the last 2 years. It's not been there for the last 10 years. Mr. Ramaphosa was the man through to us. So I got to say that politically, I think this is a mess. There's certainly a case to be made for this, that Mr. Ramaphosa is potentially cooked his goose here and has put himself into a very precarious political situation. Can't they maybe read it differently? But that's where I'm at the moment.
No, Russell. Look, I think I read it pretty much exactly the way that you do. But you know, I also take the view that us who believe in fundamentals and understand the importance of opening up the economy in the quickest possible manner, if we look in terms of what the options are that are available to us right now, limited. Because we lack the ability to, in numbers, suddenly take to the streets and demand the removal of government, because the power base of this government doesn't derive from us. So our influence to actually impose some form of radical change in terms of what is being done right now is pretty much almost non-existent, especially since world is going through pretty much the same thing. The whole thing of that, a good friend of mine, a former CFO at eMedia, Willem Nel, used to say, he said, nothing clarifies the mind.
Sorry.
And right now, we pretty much have zero options.
We missed that. Nothing clarifies the mind?
Nothing clarifies the mind like lack of options.
Lack of options. All right, good.
And right now, we really, so in as much as Russell, I agree with all of the stuff that you say about Maposa's playing 4D chess and the Ramaphosa stuff, I've never bought into the Ramaphosa stuff. Really, what I'm taking a look at right now that's emerging from within government, and again, go through this presentation that I'm currently taking a look at, and they've done a breakdown by economy, based on the economic value of each of the sectors,
right.
And again, this is kind of interesting. They look at so they're taking GDP output at basic prices based on SSA figures, obviously, because and yes, we have some in many cases about how SSA calculates this, but they look at things, for example, like the single biggest contributor to our GDP is manufacturing, which is clocking in at 11.1%, and the exposure from a manufacturing point of view to the economy in the short term is not disastrous, but opening up that sector in the immediate term is again going to be very difficult because of the exposure of risk. The second biggest sector, wholesale and retail. And then you've got agriculture, and then mining comes sort of way down. So the question for me is, are they actually running the numbers right now and actually taking a look in terms of how quickly can we open up specific sectors? The thing for them to be doing. And I don't know to what extent we be fast-tracking that process other than to make more data available and to actually try and steer the conversation around what we can do to minimize the risks in quickly opening up the sectors at risk. So I think, Russell, you know, for example, your expertise in terms of, you know, being able to read the numbers, that's a kind of useful narrative that we should be crafting. I said to Herman Pretorius after he did his presentation, you know, the most significant thing that you came up with was this whole idea of a risk scale. Because everyone gets the idea of a risk scale. You know, you can say that you have a green light for certain sectors and you have a red light for other sectors and caution mm-hmm. for the bulk of them in between. And how do you move from one risk scale? You know, we get people thinking of logic. I think the easier it becomes to put pressure on government rather than to say, hey, the lockdown is a piece of shit. The lockdown is a piece of shit. We know this. Right. But how do you start chipping away at the wedge?
Yeah, look, I hear you. I mean, a quick comment on that, guys, is I've seen the document, Kathleen, that you're referring to. This is the widely circulated document of this potential roadmap, right, that probably we think is going to inform what the president is going to say on Thursday evening. So I've seen that document. Here's the problem. Some smart thinking has gone into the recommendations. And I've seen some of the original recommendations. It's not just from the IRR. It's coming from some other quarters as well. The problem is you can give some great ideas to government. And when it gets into that government machine, it gets churned out as central planning nonsense, right? That's actually a risk. And I've gone through that document quite carefully. I'm not as optimistic as you here, Kathleen. I think that we are looking in that document at of bureaucracy and central planning scene.
No. Listen, again, we're in agreement, and I don't want you to mistake what I'm saying for optimism. Really, what I'm trying to say is, take a look at what they are currently working with. Look at to what extent we can start feeding in information. Narrative in a particular decision, and this goes back to the question, for example, of the Woolworths hot chicken thing, and you know the question comes down to, is this should this be a hill that Woolworths is prepared to die on? I don't think so at this point.
Cook chicken.
Put it in the freezer, and when the person pitches up and says, hey, I want that chicken, do you mind just sticking it in the microwave for me? Go ahead and do that. That's fine in terms of the regulations, because you're not selling hot food.
I think on this point, you know, it sounds good to say we're going to feed good ideas into the government. And, of course, there are channels to do that. But the imperviousness in government, the good ideas are readily available. They're all there. We've got a history of great ideas. They're all there. We have an ideological blockage here in the government. On that particular document, these guys are talking, and I don't know if this is going to find its way into the president's address this evening, but we've got like five levels of risk and on and off, like load shedding. Guys, it took us years just to get load shedding right, to get apps that tell us what the level is and when it's going to happen. And it's taken us like 10 years to basically. Now you're talking about turning on and off of the economy. Now, bear in mind that businesses don't just fit neatly into sectors. Businesses do different things. They do multiple things. They get supply. You know, a company that's allowed to operate at risk level 4 gets supplied from companies that are not, that may only operate at risk level 3, which is, you know, when we're opening up more of the economy. there's no congruency to this thing, guys. And that's why our proposal that we've put online at etmmacro.com is to say, listen, let's have a risk-based approach, which is what you're referring to there, Kanthan, which is the right terminology, essential versus non-essential, you know, services. This is an arbitrary, messy, bureaucratic nightmare. Go to a risk-based approach, but make exceptions to the rule that everyone may produce. The rule is everyone gets back to work, and then we'll pinpoint some exceptions, right? And we'll create some rules around safety and so on. What we have currently is an idea around risk that we'll let people back in slowly, you know, based on risk. And I just don't think that that's right. I think we've got to get everyone back to work ASAP and then and get some good risk management in place. So anyway, I don't want to go on too long about that. And Gareth, you can jump back in here. But
yeah, I mean, it's you know, there are going to be people who say, well, you've got to take an optimistic or a pessimistic approach. But I don't think that that's useful to anyone. I like what Kanthan's saying about how you can try to feed good ideas into a bad machine. And I do appreciate what you're saying too, Russell, about how sometimes that machine just spits out good ideas because they go contrary to its programming. I think we've all got to look to ourselves a little bit here. And this is where both of you as free marketeers may be quite interesting to hear from. By the way, I have an interview coming up at 8 o'clock with Colin Coleman, who was the former MD of Goldman Sachs in South Africa and is now a senior fellow lecturer at Yale University. And he has a very optimistic approach for good or for bad. And he explains himself in the interview. We had an argument about China's responsibility in this COVID crisis, which I think might be interesting to some people, because I think a lot of people like a good argument in these things. But if you're looking for a point of view that Kanthan and Russell have not espoused this morning, you may very well find it from Colin Coleman. To go back to what I'd like to hear from you, how can individuals, how can business owners, how can people who might find themselves unemployed in this economy take practical steps to make themselves survive through the course of the next few months, certainly, and beyond that, how they can make themselves useful in the economy? Do either of you have practical advice that people can start implementing in their own lives?
Okay.
Kanthan, do you want to go first?
Kanthan, you jump up.
Look, guys, you know, I think I'm in a relatively fortunate position in the sense that even though income streams have dried up, I've been relatively debt-free for the longest time. That puts me in a position of absolute privilege relative to most people in the country right now. I would seriously start taking a look right now in terms of to what extent things that one might otherwise take for granted should actually be shed in the short term. They'll be coming back in the short term. And if you happen to be a small business owner, that very expensive SUV sitting garage and not being able to do anything with it. You know, this might actually be a time to actually say, I'm cutting my losses on this. Let's get rid of that. Scale down to a Nissan 1400 bucky in the short term so that at least I'm cutting out those expenses. You're absolutely right in terms of what we were talking about earlier. Data is, then we need to keep that going. Do you really need to be spending $900 a month, though, on keeping your DSTV account active?
Right.
The answer to that is probably not. So it's really a question of taking a look at each and every one of those things in the short term. I think that's really the only thing that, as individuals, one can actually do. If you're a small business owner, look, take the view that Spur has taken, where they say that when the lockdown lifts, they will not immediately reopen businesses. Customers are not going to be there, and that is going to be economic suicide for them. A view that they'll only open up the doors again, which there's the possibility that the customers are going to flow. Every single business, I think, in this country needs to be taking that type of view. When they actually start getting into business again, and seriously, if the possibility of your being able to do that stuff, to be able to keep yourself running for the next period, staff is the way in which you keep your business alive. You must start doing that. I think it's absolutely crucial.
If I could just jump in there, I think comments, Kath, and I think that being debt-free going into this is likewise similar to you. And I think that's a great able to go into this debt-free. But for those who are not, I think we've got to say your debt, your additional debt accumulation, don't go and try not to go into too much debt. If too much personal kind of financial advice, what I want to say more from a big picture perspective, because people have a better sense of their own finances than of course I do of theirs.
Yes.
I think this is turning out worse than we thought. That's the first thing I want to say. And therefore people need to be really careful at the moment about how they futures, how they spend, security of their jobs and their businesses. I think this is turning potentially very, very ugly. If we, you know, I hope we hear something a lot better than I expect this evening from the president regarding getting out of lockdown. But I don't think we are. And I think this is turning into something quite ugly. So people need to be really careful. Final point is I think we need more civil disobedience. And, you know, I say this and it's kind of quite a radical comment, as we need, you know, people need to be able to get out there and pursue a basic fundamental human right, which is to earn a living,
yep,
on the table for their families. Starting to pressure big business. Mm-hmm. We need people pressuring their companies to open up and secure their jobs and rehire them. We need, I think, to start to muster some protest action. I don't have good ideas around this. This is not my game. We just need to start the process of disobeying bad laws. And history has shown us that bad apartheid laws were ultimately disobeyed.
Yeah.
And bad economic rules and pettiness and draconian lockdown that absolutely shuts people out of their livelihoods needs to start being disobeyed. And I think the government's going to have to realize that people are not going to stand this policy for much longer. And people just need to, I think, start adopting that kind of mindset, guys. Mm.
All right. Well, that actually is very useful personal information, because for a lot of people, the frustration is internal. And they're increasingly starting to speak out. I mean, I see lots of cars on the road. I went to the office on Monday morning, and it seems to me that a lot of people are not taking this lockdown as seriously as they were in the first week. And for many people, it comes down to desperation. You know, there was someone I interviewed in Alexandra just the other day, and this guy was standing outside, and the news reporter, without any sensitivity to the very obvious conditions that are not working for people in Alex, said, "Why are you disobeying the lockdown?" To which this guy replied, "I would rather die of COVID than of hunger." And these are not...
Which is an absolutely fair comment. Yeah.
Yeah, but this is not something glib where you can impose some kind of idea on a population where people really are in very many circumstances kind of desperate. And the people who aren't desperate are not desperate for now. And I think Russell indicates something that is likelier to become part of people's reality, that eventually you just start disobeying things that don't make sense. So thank you both very much.
Well, just in terms of stuff to disobey, Gareth, again, I'm going to say something that I've said in the past.
Yeah.
Tax evasion is a crime, but tax avoidance is your patriotic duty.
Yeah.
Just do your damnedest to make sure that as much of the money that you earn for yourself flows legally into your own pocket. I can't say this strongly enough.
Very good point. Well put. Thank you, Canton. Thank you, Russell. It's good to have both of you on. And thank you for joining us in the Burning Platform today. There will be a return to the Burning Platform next week, Thursday at 7 o'clock. And of course, if you'd like to hear some other points of view, we've often had people on here who disagree with each other. We try to make it as much of a debate as it is a discussion. And if you want to hear someone who has a kind of different take on all of this, you may want to listen to Colin Coleman coming up next. I spoke to him yesterday for half an hour, just after the announcements the previous night by the president, and looking forward to what he thinks would be the right route to take for the economy. You may want to hear from him next at 8 o'clock. That's coming right up. Plus, lots of Living in Lockdown and many other of our podcast series, which are all available on cliffcentral.com. If you want to find out, Russell, you have a podcast, so you want to give that a plug quickly?
Oh, thanks, Gareth. You know, it's not something that I'm plugging hugely at the moment. It's ETM Macro Podcast. You can look it up. It's starting to get live on most of the podcast platforms. I've had two interviews so far, one with Dr. Jonathan Witt, to Franz Cronier from the Institute of Race Relations, both being very well received. And I'll just release a couple over the next few weeks and see how people like them.
Well, the more the merrier. We want more people online, and this is where people are going for interesting information. I don't know that the mainstream media can be trusted as much as they once were, and often in first world countries like the United States and the UK, they have an interest in keeping things the same. So maybe you want to look for alternate sources of information, and certainly Russell's a credible one at that. Go and take a look. All right, thanks, everybody. We will see you tomorrow bright and early at 6 o'clock. Coming up, Colin Coleman on cliffcentral.com and living in lockdown through the course of the day. It's a busy Thursday. We have lots to talk about. You can also go and look at Blind History if you haven't done that yet. There was a new episode released this week. Catherine the Great. Thanks, everybody. We will see you tomorrow morning, Friday morning. And hopefully there's some interesting and probably positive things being said by the president tonight. Thanks very much. We'll see you later. Thanks for listening to cliffcentral.com. Podcasts of all our shows are always available on the website, the Cliff Central app, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.